From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Back in 1950, Kenya's largest city, Nairobi, was a sleepy colonial town of about 100,000. But as tens of thousands of people from the countryside began to move to the city, the Kenyan capital grew and grew fast. Today, it's a teeming metropolis of around 4 million people, and its population is growing by about 4% a year. But along with all the gleaming new skyscrapers and shopping malls, the city is feeling severe growing pains. About 60% of Nairobi's population now live in slums, often without regular access to clean water, electricity, or sewage systems. Traffic can be a nightmare. What should be a 20-minute drive from downtown to the airport often takes 2 hours. Yet Nairobi is hardly alone. Big cities all across Africa, from Abidjan in the Ivory Coast to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, are growing very, very fast. And this is due both to high birth rates and an influx of migrants from the countryside. The World Bank forecasts that the number of Africans living in cities will double to nearly 1 billion people over the next 25 years. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to take a look at the huge planning and infrastructure challenges for African cities as they undergo one of the most rapid periods of urbanization in world history. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a panel of guests with different perspectives on this issue. But first, we're going to bring in Nashan Akawa in Nairobi. He's the chairman of the Association of Construction Managers of Kenya. He's also the managing director of Beacon Africa Consultants, a construction management company. Nashan, welcome.
Thank you, Jason.
Well, start out, just talk to us about how your hometown, Nairobi, how it has changed from when you were a child up until now.
Well, I didn't grow up in Nairobi, grew up in the countryside, but I came here over a decade ago when this city is not what it was when I arrived here in the year 2005. Nairobi has changed in the last decade, as you correctly indicate in your preamble, that skyscrapers, traffic maintenance, city dwellers, slums, everything is happening in the city. In the last, I would say the last decade, it's been a tremendous growth that never seen the last decade or so. So it changed positively and to a large extent negatively.
Well, Nairobi, as you mentioned, it's really changed a lot. And in some ways, that growth, it sounds like, has been, a lot of it has been unplanned, to the extent that the Kenyan government, I understand it, has actually formed this regeneration task force, which has basically gone around over the last year or two and started demolishing a bunch of buildings, including some big shopping malls and large commercial buildings that were built illegally or built in the way of where roads or water lines were supposed to be. Why is this happening? How are people reacting to this?
Thank you, Jason. First, I'll want to admit from the onset that we have a fairly well-regulated built environment in Kenya. We have acts of parliament, regulations that properly govern us. The issue you're talking about, the demolition issues, came about because for a long time, slightly over a decade or so, we've been having developments with impunity, where there's total disregard of the set regulations of the land. So we've been having people just constructing a riparian reserve, yet there's a clear law that indicates you cannot do that. People building on road reserves, people building on waterways and all those things. In the last 1 year, the government formed the regional task force to try and clean these menace and clear the roads, the road reserves, clear the riparians that are required by law. Hence the demolitions that you'll be seeing around of the malls, of apartments coming down, of shanties on the, along the roadsides. That has been the problem. It's not that there's no regulations in Kenya or that govern construction industry fairly. It's because the people we mandated as a people to oversight on our behalf through the construction agencies failed us. They failed to do their work. They failed to supervise construction and monitor that no one constructs on riparian reserves or road reserves or waterways.
So it sounds like, I'm sorry, Nashan, so it sounds like there are, in your view, there are good laws and good regulations for the development of Nairobi, but the people charged with enforcing them haven't been doing their jobs well. And you mentioned riparian areas or wetlands that are have been built upon too. What effect has this had on Nairobi when it it rains, the fact that so many of these wetland areas have been built upon?
Well, Jason, in the last 2 decades or so, we have faced acidity, for example, flooding that is, I would say, abnormal. The high volume surface runoff of water from developments that are unplanned and uncoordinated, and yet our road water systems have remained the same since colonial times. Nothing has changed in our road systems, and yet developments have been built all over without any plan. So it has led to flooding, a lot of flooding. In the last 1 month, the county government has been cleaning waterways and tunnels to so that, as we expect the long rain in May, there's no flooding. But we have had flooding for the last 10 years, unprecedented in the last 1 year or so, due to this uncoordinated and unplanned development. So the consequences of not following these regulations is dire. Our environment is deteriorating. The flooding systems here, you mentioned traffic. It's worse. It's worse probably the last 1 year or so.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to this issue of traffic because I think this is something that affects everyone that has to move anywhere in a city. Nairobi, as I mentioned, is growing 4 to 5% a year. More than half of the population already lives in slums where people don't necessarily have regular access to running water, to sewage facilities, to electricity. As more and more people are moving to Nairobi because of the amount of jobs there, the opportunity there, what needs to happen to make sure that there is adequate housing for people when they come?
Look, we had a plan, our Metropolitan Growth Strategy Plan of 1973, expired in the year 2000. You realize that close to 18 or so years, this city has been under growth momentum without a plan. There's no master plan for this city. Our zoning regulation is outdated. It's done during colonial times. It can't be implemented now. So what has happened? We have had developments that are coming up without any zoning regulation guideline to those developments. And hence the effect of the traffic. We have had traffic on areas in Nairobi where traffic never happened before. Remember, Nairobi is experiencing a very high urbanization, almost 500,000 people yearly, and a high population growth rate. These two has exerted a lot of pressure into the infrastructure of Nairobi system, and roads is no exception. So we are building, people are coming to the city, the growth is going up, yet our infrastructure system is not working. Hence, the slums coming up because still our poverty levels are still going down. So the city is growing, income levels are low. There's no infrastructure to cater for those growth. What happens? The traffic grows up, the slums grow up.
Well, Noshana Kawa, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the big challenges for African cities as they undergo rapid population growth. The number of Africans living in urban areas has grown rapidly in recent decades and is expected to double again in just 25 years. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in three experts who've been tracking this issue closely. Joining us from Cape Town, South Africa, is Nancy Udendal. She's the chairwoman of the Association of African Planning Schools. She's also a professor in the School of Architecture, Planning, and Geomatics at the University of Cape Town. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Also with us in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, is Priya Menaring. She's a countries economist for the UK-based International Growth Center. Priya, welcome.
Thanks, Jason.
And on the line from London is Zoe Tabari. She's the property rights editor for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. Zoe, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Well, it's a pleasure to have all of you. Nancy Udendal, if I could start with you, African cities are hardly alone in facing these planning challenges. You know, many of the problems they have are a result of decisions made by their own local and national governments. But some of these problems also seems like they're a result of how these cities were laid out by colonial governments 60, 70 years ago. Talk to us about how this has created some problems as the cities have grown.
Yeah, I mean, these cities were planned to be segregated, right? They were planned to essentially serve the colonial elite. And of course, after many countries gained their independence, we needed a kind of new strategies to deal with the growth of cities in Africa. And basically what a lot of these African countries were stuck with then were old planning tools, old colonial planning tools to plan for the future of cities. Which were highly and still are highly ineffective. I mean, you heard Nashon earlier on, you know, the city of Nairobi was working with a plan that was prepared in 1973, which is probably one of the more recent plans that get used in many African cities to plan for the future of its kind of urbanization.
Well, Priyam Manwaring, if I could bring you into this, you're in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, which is right on the shores of Lake Victoria. And I understand that Kampala's physical footprint has more than quadrupled just since the early 1990s. The population has more than doubled. How has the Ugandan government, how has the Kampalan local authorities, how have they done in sort of providing water and sewage and transport for all these new people that have come pouring in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a significant challenge, particularly because there hasn't, I mean, it's true of basically cities across Africa, but also true in Kampala, that there are extremely limited resources that city governments are working with, and they're having to try and plan for the expansion of cities and for people who are coming in who aren't currently there, but will be there in 20 years. And so there's always a conflict that governments have between serving the existing areas where there's urban development and planning for future development. But I suppose the challenge is that when you have rapidly urbanizing cities, the best case scenario would be one in which governments are planning for the future, because it's three times as costly to retrofit infrastructure in cities rather than planning for them and planning for people who are about to come. So I think that Kampala is facing similar challenges to cities all across Africa in terms of there being a large amount of population pressure on things like housing, on water and sanitation, on transport in particular in Kampala, and the city governments having limited resources with which to actually address those problems.
And Zoe Tabar, you visited a number of cities in Africa for your work. How does this issue of property rights and land tenure, how does this feed into some of the challenges that many African countries are facing?
They're very closely connected, Jason. I think, Nashon was talking about the fast rates of urbanization in African cities. And what I think we've seen, not just kind of in Nairobi, but other African cities as well, is that kind of years of rapid growth coupled with, unplanned growth and a lack of or poor infrastructure has meant that in many African cities, more than half of the residents live in slums. And often that's without any title deeds or kind of formal property rights, meaning that when either property developers step in or when city planners have to upgrade areas, those communities often have no means of proving the ownership of their land or of their home and are the first to go. And that's something we're seeing not just in kind of Nairobi, but frequently in West Africa as well. Or, for example, in Accra in Ghana or in Liberian cities, you have a huge part of the population that lives in slums on the coast, which is, of course, fast eroding. And who, when disaster strikes, because they have no title deeds or proof of ownership, have no means of claiming insurance and rebuilding their homes.
Well, Nancy Odendahl, countries in North America and Europe went through periods of sustained rapid urbanization in the past. How is the urban boom that's taking place in Africa right now, how is it different than what the U.S. and Europe experienced, several decades ago, 100 years ago?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I mean, the root of urban planning is basically stems from industrialization in England and in North America, and of course much of Europe as well. So what we're dealing with in Africa is informal urbanization largely. You have the kind of growth rates that are really very difficult to prepare cities for. You have under-resourced local governments that are not entirely autonomous either, that have to plan for infrastructure for urban growth. But I think the distinguishing features is around what people come to cities for and what's available to them. We certainly don't have the industrial growth and the growth in industrial jobs, manufacturing jobs that accompanied urbanization in northern countries. So informality is here to stay.
Yeah, what do you mean by informality? Talk to us about what you mean by the sort of the informal economy.
So informality relates to to informal housing. So, I mean, I'm not condoning, you know, slum development as a viable option for households, because obviously there's health risks and slums are often located on very precarious land. But the point is, when people do not have housing available to themselves, they're going to create housing. And it often is on leftover pieces of land or precarious pieces of land that is all that is available to them. And then the other part of the informal, of course, is it's informal work, street vendors, people working from home, having little shops at home. In South Africa, we call them spaza shops, or people kind of creating jobs for themselves by working in the informal economy in transport, in paratransit. In Nairobi, we talk about the matatus. So there's a...
Matatus, these are like the little vans that drive around taking people from place to place, sort of an informal public transit system.
That's it. So if the you know, if the demand for jobs and the demand for housing is not matched with supply, which it isn't, then people are going to fend for themselves.
Priya, anyway, if you could pick up on this point, because in many countries, sort of throughout history, urbanization, as people have moved to the cities, generally what's happened is that there's been greater economic growth and rising living standards for the people that move to the cities. But in some parts of Africa, that doesn't seem to be the case so much. So explain to us why that is.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that you're still, by and large, seeing that people's living standards and their incomes are going up when they're going to cities. It's just that it's not nearly in the same way as an engine of growth that you saw in now developed countries. So you'll have, instead of having urban economies driven, as Nancy was saying, by industrial growth and productive jobs, you'll instead see what we sometimes call consumption cities, which are largely driven by people being engaged in low value added services, and which are by definition not tradable across borders. So you'll see lots of in Kampala, for example, there's a huge amount of tailoring businesses, because it would be so expensive to try and trade some of those very specialized services that they can continue to operate in these cities. But ultimately, they're not globally competitive activities, and therefore we're not seeing sort of cities acting as engines of growth, and it's not fulfilling their potential in terms of being able to bring together large amounts of people and workers and connect them in a way that can allow for sort of sharing of ideas and increasing productivity.
Okay, yeah. So in some ways, then it sounds like it's hard to create wealth if a big part of the economy is people tailoring each other's clothes or selling each other vegetables in the market or things like that. But Zoe Tabari, if I could talk to you, I wanted to ask you if there are some cities that are maybe models that have done this really effectively, that have faced some of the same challenges that these sort of super cities like Lagos in Nigeria and others in Africa have faced. Like, are there examples of ways to do this urbanization you know, in the best way possible?
Absolutely. So I think we're seeing a lot of pockets of innovation in a number of African cities. One of which we reported on recently at the Thomson Reuters Foundation was Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, which up till recently didn't have any traffic signs, speed bumps or footpaths outside many schools, which meant that children walking outside of school to class were often being hit by cars. And so recently, a small non-profit in Africa kind of got the government's permission to install these features itself. And as a result, has reduced child injuries by, I think it's something about like 25% recently. And in fact, last month, I believe they won the US-based World Resources Institute prize, the Ross Prize for Cities this year, which kind of recognizes achievements in urban transformation around the world. So, you know, that's kind of one innovation coming from an African city. Another one, which is really interesting, I thought, not necessarily just in terms of infrastructure, but in terms of making cities more inclusive. And I think we're going to see more and more of this as you know, urban populations swell, is something that's called Bicycle Stockvel, which Nancy may have heard of. This is a collective that started in Johannesburg recently, and that uses kind of bicycles to cross the physical and social boundaries that were created by apartheid. So essentially, these rides grow up to about a kind of 150 people. Anyone's free to join, and the group provides bikes for anyone who needs one. And the idea behind it is to try to help young people living in townships overcome the limitations imposed on them by apartheid urban planners through things like cycling, art, and music. Some very different and interesting examples of innovation we're seeing across African cities.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about how African cities will manage what's projected to be a historic population surge in the continent's cities over the next several decades. We're joined by Nancy Udendal of the Association of African Planning Schools in the University of Cape Town, Priya Manwaring of the International Growth Center, and Zoe Tabari of the Thomson Reuters Foundation. Nancy Udendal, we heard Zoe Tabari talking about this initiative in South Africa involving bicycles as a way of sort of urban regeneration, if you will. But South Africa, of course, has a particularly sort of unique history given the legacy of apartheid and how separate whites and blacks lived in the country and how formalized the patterns of settlement were there. Talk to us about some of the specific challenges that poses for South Africa.
Yeah. I mean, the South African city is typically quite different from cities elsewhere in Africa, and that you do see evidence of a much bigger middle class, and yet you also see evidence of extreme inequality. The city I live in Cape Town is seen as one of the most unequal cities in the world. So you know the problem is really severe, but there's also many opportunities for tackling the problem. There are more resources. Local government is far more decentralized, so you find that there's more room for kind of innovation at the local government level, and the spatial planning system has moved on to a more sort of strategic form of spatial planning that is quite different from the kind of master planning that we sort of realize does not work that well anymore. So I'm not saying South Africa's got the solution to all the problems, but I think what you are seeing is a kind of genuine commitment to forms of planning that are kind of far more strategic, and that is sort of recognize moments of kind of creativity and experimentation far more. And I think that's largely due to a sort of planning system that had to be completely reworked post-apartheid. So that presented us with an opportunity to change the way we do things.
And Priya Manwaring, if I could turn this to you as well. We heard at the top of the program, we heard Noshan Alkawa talking about this regeneration program in Nairobi that basically involved the government knocking down a lot of buildings that had been built illegally in the pathway of where roads were supposed to go, or on top of parks, or shacks right next to, obviously that's very politically difficult. I know that in a number of countries, basically it sounds like the plan has been to just sort of start over and to create these new sort of satellite cities on green fields in the countryside. Talk to us about that. What are some of the advantages or disadvantages of that approach?
That's a good question. I mean, I would be wary of, I don't know of that much evidence around comparing these initiatives to build whole new cities. The ones that I've heard of are largely around, you know, moving administrative capitals of countries to different areas. But as far as I'm aware, there aren't a huge amount of cases of success when trying to rebuild cities entirely anew. And instead, it seems to me, at least, to be a more sustainable solution. If you're thinking about cities that you currently have that are extremely difficult to plan around, and I think that some combination of planning for future expansion of those cities that is happening, whether governments like it or not, is extremely important. So doing things like there were World Bank type what's called sites and settlement schemes that were done, piloted in the 1970s, that are now showing results in countries like Tanzania, where you basically just provide the basic infrastructure for future expansion of the city, so just roads, maybe property rights and basic water and sanitation, for example, and so you provide kind of the basic plan for expansion of the city, but then allow people to privately invest. So some combination of providing that skeleton of development for current cities, whilst also using, there are lots of innovative schemes that cities are now using to replan areas within a city that don't rely on these sort of large scale land acquisition and where people are displaced from their homes. So in Kampala, for example, the city is, I think, quite successfully trying implementing land readjustment schemes, which are basically where the government will agree with private landowners that if private landowners voluntarily give up part of their land to the city, that the city can use the collectively donated land to provide a road that will service a neighborhood, for example. So it's these sort of win-win solutions where individuals are able to retain ownership and live in a certain area, but then still get adequate services for that for living and productivity of the city.
And Zoe Tabari, if you could pick up on that point, also about satellite cities, I understand that these have been built in a number of different countries, in Tanzania, in Kenya, some other places as well, Rwanda. What do you make of this effort to sort of start anew and have sort of brand new planned cities and developments?
I mean, I think they certainly show a willingness from governments and urban planners to, you know, upgrade cities, prepare them for future challenges, the twin challenges of climate change and urbanization. I think so far, though, at least on the ones we've reported on at TRF, we've seen a mixed reception. So starting in Kenya, for example, with Tilisi or Tatu City in Northland City, you know, while developers say that they kind of will provide homes, offices, kind of schools and more so, you know, a new lifestyle experience, as they call it, to residents. Critics have said that they have warned that they could increase, not only increase inequality, but that they're also allowing government to kind of neglect its commitment to building affordable housing. So in Kenya, for example, I think the government had committed to building something like 2 million affordable homes that it needs to meet housing deficit and stem the growth of slums. And critics of Tbilisi and those other satellite cities are saying that this could kind of further delay the building of those homes. And interestingly, I think when you look at kind of other countries, even outside of the African continent, you've had similar criticisms. So in just 100 smart cities, for example, looking at Lavasa, or say in Toronto's new kind of waterfront neighborhood, which is designed to be entirely its first kind of smart city neighborhood, that you're kind of also getting criticism on rising inequality.
So the danger is they become kind of like gated compounds for the middle class, for the upper middle class, that separates them from the poor in a way.
I was going to say criticism you're seeing elsewhere, and which may kind of be the case with African satellite cities, is privacy concerns as well. So for example, in satellite cities which try to make more use of technology and to kind of gather residents' data or crowdfund their data, increasingly we're seeing concerns, hearing concerns about what could happen to that data and whether it could be sold either to corporate entities or used by the government to other ends.
And Nancy Odendahl, we're just about out of time, but in just about 30 seconds, what are one or two things that you think we could really be focusing on, that governments, aid agencies could be focusing on to address this problem over the next 10, 15 years as we're expecting this huge wave of population growth in cities?
Well, I think you know, sort of governments and city planners need to get real about what African urbanization looks like and understand that it's not going to look anything like what's going on or what used to go on in North America and Europe with regards to the first wave of industrialization. And I think the second point I want to make is I would argue as a city planner that the solution lies in mobility systems. You build more roads, you get more cars, you get more traffic. If you start looking quite seriously at the interface between mobility systems and land use planning, you start getting cities that actually work. And you see examples of that in Latin America, such as Bogota and Curitiba.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Nashan Akawa, Nancy Udendahl, Priya Menwaring, and Zoe Tabari for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Seth Bodine, Lara Cumming, and Michelle Stoddard. Edom Kasae is supervising producer. Megan Smaltz is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.